flying coach means, Wukong says. But I am glad to hear that you do not invade the space of others.
Yes, I have long thought that reclining your seat on an airplane is a sure sign of moral turpitude. Unless, of course, there's a spinal or other medical condition involved. What are you doing there?
Sun Wukong slaps the wall with his knuckles in sequence that's clearly designed, and once he completes it, a panel slides to the left and reveals a hidden wall safe. He spins the dial and smirks at me over his shoulder.
I am getting the special ingredients for your tea.
You have some kind of food in a safe? Is that, safe?
Yes, you may relax and depend on my methods of preservation.
Of course, yes. A click and a twist of the handle and the safe swings open to reveal a glass container with a lid on it. No bearer bonds, no blocks of illicit drugs, just a covered bowl of fruit, which Wukong removes with reverence.
Ah, do they not look marvelous?
I'm not sure what I'm looking at. Slices or wedges of pale yellow fruit? Are those mangoes? Papaya?
No, these are immortal peaches.
I blink and look up at him, then back at the fruit and back at him. Immortal peaches, like the ones you stole thousands of years ago to extend your life, upsetting the heavens?
The very same, but taken with permission this time.
And you're going to make bubble tea out of those?
Precisely!
For me.
Indeed!
He puts the bowl down on the prep area and uncovers it, and the most exquisite smell of peaches wafts about the room. I close my eyes and simply smell it. Divine. Some blending happens after that. Some sloshing noises and the crisp snap of a plastic lid on top of a cup.
Here you are,
Wukong finally says. I open my eyes and behold a yellow-orange liquid.
Your original order. Immortal peach bubble tea.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. I take it carefully and bow to him and he nods in return. He offers me a straw and I stick it through the little hole in the lid and sip. It is the most exquisite taste to ever roll across my tongue. I know I shall forever eat peaches, hoping to taste the memory of this drink, and they will never compare. And it is not simply the taste of the tea that is sensational. It has a clear, immediate effect on my body. My exhaustion disappears, and my muscles feel strong and ready again. I wish I had the words to express how wonderful this is, I tell Wukong. It deserves its own poetry.
You enjoy poetry?
I do. I'm memorizing Polish poetry right now for my next headspace. I think I would like to study Mandarin afterward, though.
Oh, there are many fine poets in that language, especially from the Tang Dynasty. Have you heard of Wang Wei?
No, I haven't.
He writes of nature quite often, so I expect you would appreciate him. Let me see. Perhaps I can translate a couple of lines you might like.
His voice deepens and rolls across my eardrums like thunder in the prelude to a summer storm.
Look, I make no plans for the future, but to go back to my forest home again.
Its brevity surprises me, but I do find it evocative and the sort of plan I would always have for myself, no matter my age. I suddenly miss Orla and her puppies, and Atticus and Oberon, and marvel again at the power of a few words to evoke emotion within us. That sounds lovely.
It is,
Wukong agreed.
And it was. Let us hope we have both a future and a forest after this. Chapter 13.
I rather thought that business with the kobolds was enough risking of me life for the day, but almost as soon as I think it and make plans to catch up with me grove, I get a request to investigate some mess back in North America. I'm Starkers, and it's something that happens so frequently for both of us that Greta set up a clothing cache in the forest near her cabin, next to the bound tree. Just an old bureau she found at a thrift shop. It's far enough away from the house that me apprentices won't see me appear, though that's not a concern, since they're still on that very long flight home. I shift there long enough to get a fresh pair of jeans and a shirt, before following the call of the elemental to the northern United States. The Lewis Range of the Rocky Mountains, which runs north and south over the border between Montana and Alberta, had a portal open up a wee while ago, and temperatures in the region began dropping all out of proportion to what could be called normal. On the Montana side, it's part of Glacier National Park, which I've heard tell of before. Mostly I've heard that it used to contain glaciers, but in the last century they've melted away like popsicles in an oven. Once I shift to the area, I ask the elemental what's the problem.
Unknown source of cold to the north. Find and report.
All right. Reconnaissance is easy enough. But I'm feeling the chill already. It's cold enough for me nipples to be used as diamond saws. It's still dark here, and I cast night vision to see better. But even with the elevation and time of day, it shouldn't be quite so cold. With a sigh of resignation, I strip off the clothes I just put on and bind my shirt to a red kite, taking wing into the freezing air. Curiously, once I get a few hundred feet above the mountain tops, the air actually gets warmer. Not balmy by any means. It's still feckin' cold. But there's a noticeable difference, and it's not the natural sort. Normally you get colder, not warmer, as you climb higher. I point myself north and am awestruck by what I see. These rocky mountains are beautiful, even in the frigid blue tones of night. I never saw the like before. The Bavarian Alps were fine, make no mistake, but I didn't get to admire them from above. I surely never got to see such things in Ireland, or on me few trips to the European continent in the old days. I saw some grand cliffs, and some fantastic hills, but nothing like these mountains. I could see a druid falling in love with land like this. The air gets even warmer as I head north, and eventually I'm able to see why. There's a pack of frost giants on the mountains, actively sucking the cold out of the air and leaving only heat behind, bizarrely creating something close to a thermal updraft. And they're taking all that cold and moisture and making themselves a bit of a shelter out of ice. They have a lot of bags and parcels scattered around them, and one of them is using a shovel to dig a fire pit, though maybe that's wishful thinking on my part. I sure could go for a cozy fire. Watching actual ice and snow crystallize from their outstretched hands to form frozen walls is what identifies them. Otherwise I would have thought them nothing more than tall lads with powder blue skin, maybe some kind of fae. But what are frost giants from the Norse stories doing here? The portal that brought them, at least, seems to have closed. But who opened it? I begin to circle them, counting on the night and the tendency of people not to look up to keep me concealed, and work through what I know. The original story, Sir Ragnarok, suggested it was to begin with years of cold, to soften up the human plane, Midgard, they call it, and make it ripe for conquering. Perhaps that's still a part of the plan, except they're going to try it on a different continent. Maybe Loki figures once he gets the other hemisphere under control, this one will fall easily later on if it's frozen out just as spring begins. North America will lose a growing season, and suddenly you'll have famine conditions in the land of plenty. Weak folks put up a weak fight. Maybe that's it. But they don't look like they're any sort of military force. They have a couple of wee ones with them. Giant kids. These are families. Bright movement in the sky attracts me gaze eastward. There are streaks of orange in the dark, like a meteor shower passing by so close ye should be screaming. And while many of them pass high overhead in the upper reaches of the atmosphere, heading to points west, methinks some will be landing nearby. One of them, indeed, ploughs into the ground short of our position, maybe a kilometer or more to the east, landing on the side of the mountain in a stand of timber, which immediately ignites a full acre or so, the opposite of a cozy fire. These things are fireballs, not meteors. Landing on a patch of forest like that, where there's no easy way to fight the fire, means it's gonna burn for days. Unless, of course, these frost giants decide to do something about it. And they do. There's some angry grunting and pointing at the sky. Then four of the giants break off from the group and take long, loping strides toward the site where the fireball hit. Must mean that the fire giant cert has emerged from must blame. There are gonna be fires all over the world, and I wonder if any of them will make it down to the Flagstaff area. There's a whole lot of dry pine around there, lot of trees everywhere, really. These fires are gonna ravage the planet. I drift away from the frost giants, working on the shelter, and follow the ones heading for the fire. They have some rough terrain to navigate, but those long legs help them scramble down. It's probably 20 minutes until they can make it there, and by that time the fire's not only caught on, it's spreading. They combine their talents and start throwing snow at the flames, lifting it right off the ground and smothering the tree trunks and branches with it. It's gonna take them some time, but they'll have this fire contained and extinguished in an hour, I'm guessing. And that kind of behavior doesn't fit with him being agents of Loki. If they're on the same side, they should be laughing about that fire, rubbing their hands together like villains and muttering darkly about how the world will soon be theirs. The shelter they're building is above the tree line, so they wouldn't be threatened by it, unless they're wanting to preserve the habitat here for animals. That's a different kind of long-term thinking, that is. That's the sort of thing ye do if ye want to stay. That's what ye do if ye want to protect your neighborhood. I circle back around to where the group is working on their shelter and take a closer look. It's not a bunker or barracks that's forming up there. That's a home. Two of the giants, a man and a woman, are putting some decorative touches on the front pillars. Little whirls in blossoms in ice. They're smiling at each other and saying, "Grrrr," whatever that means. I wish I could talk to them, but they speak Old Norse, a language I never picked up. But add it all up. The kind of shelters, the makeup of the group, the baggage. And these are most likely refugees. These families don't want any part of Ragnarok or Loki's shenanigans. They want a safe place to raise their kids. And this particular slice of the Rockies has few humans running around. Sheehan told me about the national park. It only has a couple of roads, and they're closed off for the winter and much of the spring. The frost giant's only true chance of running into somebody would be mountain climbers in the summer. And if they kept this peak covered in snow and ice throughout, not difficult at these elevations, then even that would be unlikely. I can't tell for certain, of course. Maybe they have some sinister agenda packed away in one of those bags. But they're not behaving like they want to destroy the world. They're acting like they want to hide in this one wee corner of it, bothering no one. Fact is, they're not doing anything now that's worth me putting on the knuckles. They opened a portal, and that raised an alarm with the elemental, but now it's closed, and so far they've done nothing else but make a cold place a bit colder, build an ice house, and put out a fire. Seems like this could be a non-crisis. I spiral down to the north of them all to report to the elemental. 12 frost giants, building shelter, plans unknown, I say. Then add that the portal is closed, though the elemental surely knows that already.
"Very well. Watch and wait,"
the elemental says, and I decide it's best to shapeshift into a bear on the spot. There's no use for me to freeze if this is going to take a while, and bears can handle the cold a bit better. I pad through the snow and find a place where I can watch the frost giants from a distance. They have that cozy fire going now in the pit, and they're starting work on a second house. The couple who are decorating that first house, they're taking a moment to stand back and admire it and smile. The man spreads his arms, closes his eyes, and takes a deep breath as he turns in place. He grunts and nods, and the woman says, "Grrrr," and nods back. They like it here. And what's not to like? It's fakin' beautiful, and if I liked the freezing cold, I'd want to stay too. How they got here, who opened the portal and closed it again, is something I'd like to know. But it doesn't appear to be an urgent matter requiring me attention. These folks have demonstrated by their actions that they're here to build and preserve rather than destroy. Meanwhile, I know right well there's plenty of destruction happening elsewhere. Those fireballs are most likely going to do damage wherever they land, except in perhaps the ocean, but the elementals seem content to let those burn or let someone else take care of them. Plant life can come back from fires. It's tougher to come back from the drains and death that portals cause. Watching the frost giants build their wee hamlet, I'm wondering if we might not work with them if they're going to be staying here a while. I might be able to bind tons of carbon to the ice if they're going to rebuild the glaciers. Could be good for the region, and good for the world. Ooh, I'd need Sheahan to talk to him, though. I hope he's managing all right. The frost giants who'd left to fight the fire eventually return and help build the houses. It's a bit after dawn when they figure they've done enough, and disappear inside them for some rest. I let the elemental know that they're harmless, and I'm glad to see that. She gives me permission to leave and get some rest in one instant and then takes it back the next. She relays a distress call from near the equator. Something horrible is happening in Peru.
Chapter 14. After the fire, I expected the ice. The frost giants were, by all accounts, on Loki's side and eager to transform the world. But for some reason only a few emerged from the Norse plain to cool down the area where Surt had stood and smooth the way for the Horde. And it was indeed a horde of Draugr, the spirit-filled undead from hell, that bubbled up out of the volcano's cone. That spirit inside them prevented me from unbinding them like vampires, and they were tough to kill otherwise. They had to be decapitated, or somehow have their brains scrambled to be defeated, and they had a couple of squiffy dodges that made even that rough. They could swell up or shrink fairly easily, and were also semi-corporeal. They could pass through solids, or let solids pass through them, if they wanted. Sort of like those spooky twins from the second Matrix movie, except a smidge slower and without a sense of humor or fabulous hair extensions. They had very little going for them in the way of fashion. They did have swords, shields, and helmets, but everything else pretty much was left to hang out. And I'm not just talking about naughty bits, I'm talking intestines and organs, their manifestations looking an awful lot like hell herself, except the various bits of Draugr flesh were largely gray and bloodless. They were dead meat wagons for the saddest of spirits, and rather unappetizing meat at that, like 9 steps down from fast food roast beef. Behind us, a couple of putting greens away, the darkened sky thundered and a rainbow descended from the sky to earth. It was yet another portal to the Norse plain, but this time originating from Asgard. Troops marched down 10 wide on the Bifrost Bridge, far better armored and looking far less dead, even though in practical terms they were the same as the Draugr, spirits riding around in manifested flesh. They were the Einherjar, the valorous dead selected by the Valkyries to live in Valhalla and dine with Odin, practicing for this final battle every day for centuries. They had to train vigorously and get really good at the killing bit, because the valorous dead were far less numerous than all the other dead. They sure did look fancy, marching in ranks and with their Spangen helms all buffed and polished up, their wooden shields brightly painted. But they were going to be vastly outnumbered. The Norse did have some gods on their side to even things out. Behind the Einherjar, Odin rode on a magnificent, if rather ordinary, horse. I was the reason he wasn't riding Sleipnir. I was the reason any of this was happening, in fact. Valkyries circled above Odin on white-winged horses. Frigg rode next to him, and behind him, in a chariot pulled by flying cats, rode Freya. More of the Aesir followed behind, as did many of the Vanir, dwarfs from Nidavellir and elves from Alfheim. But I still doubted we would prevail without more help. More help soon arrived, before the Rainbow Bridge was finished offloading its troops. Yet another portal opened to my left, and at first I thought it was another fire giant rising from Muspelheim, but quickly saw my mistake. It was Briat, in her battle dress, rising on a pillar of flame, and behind her came not only her own Fey host, but another army we had coaxed to our side, the Dark Elves from Svartalfheim. Now it was starting to look like we had a prayer. Briat noted the Draugr hordes mustering under a banner and moved toward me to parley. Her eyes flicked to the large Fey host and noted Fand and Munanin waiting to receive her, but she did not acknowledge them yet. Instead, she dropped to the earth in a scorched circle, extinguished her flames, and removed her helmet.
Sheahan, why are you standing here by yourself?
I am less than popular with pretty much everyone I'm to fight alongside today.
Including the Olympians, eh?
Olympians? Where? Briat pointed over my shoulder. There, behind me and to my left, were many of the Greco-Roman deities. Zeus, Jupiter, Hermes, and Mercury floated in midair above the others. As before, when I'd met him in England, Zeus had a visible erection underneath his toga, because the prospect of violence excited him so. The Apollos were there, as were Ares, and Mars, and Athena, and Minerva. I had never seen the latter four in person, and I did not want to get into a fight with any of them. The gods of war appeared to be comfortably wearing enough steel for a heavy-duty truck, and gripped huge weapons and shields. The goddesses of wisdom were a bit more sensibly armored, but looked no less deadly. Athena's owl was perched on her left shoulder. Minerva's flew lazy circles around the Olympians from above. I was relieved to note the absence of Bacchus and Diana, since either or both of them would enjoy filleting me and feeding me to their dogs. We waved to them, and the Olympians gave us curt nods in return. Zeus's toga twitched.
"Has Hel or Loki emerged yet?"
Briat asked, her gaze turning to the volcano slopes, which still poured out more and more Draugr. "Not visibly. They may have, though. Either could be wearing a disguise and watching us right now."
"Hmm,"
Briat considered and shook her head.
"Perhaps that would be true of Hel. She has the same blackened heart, but does not have the bloated ego of her father. Loki will reveal himself, I feel sure. His constitution demands it. He must preen and be seen to be powerful. He may be part of the Horde now, but eventually he will make himself a target."
"That sounds quite likely to me. When he does, though, is there already a plan that you know of to take him out? Because he is immune to both fire and lightning."
"Lightning?" Briat scowled. "Didn't Thor used to punish him with that?"
"Perhaps so, in the past. But Pirun sent multiple bolts at Loki since he escaped, and he was unaffected."
"Well, he is not immune to steel, and we have plenty of that to go around."
Briat's eyes slid left and right to make sure no one else was in listening range, and then she lowered her voice.
"In fact, we have a little wager afoot on who's going to get him. My money's on Ares. You want in?"
"Sure. Who's available?"
"You are, for one."
"I am? Nobody thinks I'll be the one to get him?"
"Not so far. The gods of war and the thunder gods are taken, as are the Apollos and all the Norse gods. So am I, plus Fand and Munanin."
"Well, what if I do get him and nobody's bet on me?"
"Then you win everything. The one to get him gets half the winnings, and whoever bet on that person gets the other half."
"Nobody's taken the goddesses of wisdom?"
"They're free."
"Then give me 20 on Athena." Briat scowled.
"When I said money, I was speaking metaphorically. I did not mean we're using modern systems of payment."
"Then what's the buy-in? Oh, not favors to be named later, I hope."
"No, it's..."
She paused, sighed, and rolled her eyes.
"It wasn't my idea, all right. Odin insisted, and it's all your fault."
"Of course it is. Everything's my fault."
"We're using Girl Scout cookies. 1,000 boxes. Winner chooses what kind."
"Are you joking with me right now?"
"I am not. Odin is obsessed with them ever since that time you gave him Samoas."
"Then 1,000 boxes of Girl Scout cookies on Athena."
"Fine.
Out of curiosity, who did Odin pick?
Freya. Now, if you will excuse me, I must greet Muninen and Fand.
I was abruptly alone again, and hyper-aware that I may have as many enemies on my side as against the forces of Hell. The Olympians did not come over to say hi, nor did the Fae or the Dark Elves. I might have to watch my back every bit as much as my front, though except for the Dark Elves and some of the Fae, I did not think of the forces on our side as backstabbers. Certainly not any of the deities. Though there was one I was hoping to see precisely because of his backstabbing ability, but didn't see yet. Coyote hadn't shown up, and he'd left me little hope that he would. I was pretty sure we'd get some interference from normal folks soon, however. Mere mortals, as the Olympians might call them. Every scientific instrument they had pointed in this general direction must be going bonkers. So far, 3 different portals had opened near here, and there'd been an unheralded eruption to boot. Add to that the atmospheric disturbances that Zeus and Jupiter were no doubt causing by floating there, and we could expect all kinds of investigation soon from the Swedish government, and probably other governments as well, at least via satellite. The amount of fodder this would provide the tinfoil hat crew would last for decades. I wished I could joke with Oberon about it. He'd make me laugh and calm me down. But at the same time, I was glad he wasn't here. The likelihood of him surviving such a battle as this would be small. My own chances looked fairly dismal. The Draugr continued to pour out of the mountain and sort themselves on its slope and its base, facing our own mustered forces. Once the flow finally trickled to a stop, the mountain convulsed near the top, but what erupted was not lava. I groaned and got to my feet. It was a massive gray hound, much bigger than Oberon, and its name was Garm, the Hound of Hell. And Hell came with him. There are few motifs more tiresome in history than the power-mad guy who wants to shape the world to suit his desires. Sometimes the power-mad guy spawns hellish offspring that are just as bad or worse, though. Wee monsters that grow up to be big monsters, bereft of empathy or much in the way of soul that is not a small, starved, mewling thing. Loki and his children were cut from that cloth. Hel stepped out of the caldera and kept growing, half of her a gray-skinned corpse and half of her exposed bone and flesh and pulsing organs. Behind her, the bright, fiery hair of Loki rose. The god of mischief grinned madly as he emerged, swelling to gargantuan proportions. They towered over the field using their shape-shifting ability, standing 60 meters tall or more, like some giant mecha suit from an apocalyptic anime. Loki held a flaming sword that I recognized, though it too was much larger than it used to be, and he pointed it in our general direction. His voice boomed across the fields like thunder.
"Kill them all!" he said. "Scourge them from the plain of Midgard!"
The much larger army of Draugr surged forward to meet ours, outnumbering us 4 or 5 to 1. Someone on our side blew a horn high up in the air, and it came from behind me to the right where the Bifrost Bridge had settled. I turned to see who had signaled the charge, expecting to see Odin, but it wasn't him at all. There was a latecomer to the party. A chariot floating in the air, drawn by 2 goats, and a red-haired, heavily muscled figure standing in it. "No, it can't be," I mumbled, but he let the horn fall away from his bearded face and held up a hammer to the sky. Lightning coalesced around it, and he redirected it to strike amongst the oncoming horde, a pointless gesture since the Draugr were unaffected by the electricity, allowing the bolts to pass through their phantasmal flesh. He'd have to hammer them into oblivion if he wanted to make them go away, because Loki and Hel would not let something so elementary as lightning thwart them now. But the stark fact of his presence was proof that he'd never gone away when I thought he had.
"They suckered me somehow," I breathed.
"That's bloody Thor." Chapter 15. Seven Star Mountain explodes again. It is a howling, ravenous force with which I am unprepared to deal. This is a battle meant for gods, not a woman from Kansas by way of Arizona.
Wukong, I say, I still do not know why I'm here.
And the answer still remains, to learn and grow.
The grin he flashes me is mischievous. He knows full well how annoying he's being right now.
To learn what, though? To grow in what way? I am willing to do both and to work for whatever goal you set before me, but what you have said so far is too vague for me to understand.
Do you think you were brought here to fight the hordes of the Yama Kings? To fight, perhaps, the Yama Kings themselves?
No, I do not. That is the source of my doubt. You cannot possibly expect me to fight them.
Oh, but I do. But they are not the true fight. They will kill you if you do not strive your utmost. Do not mistake my words. But defeating them is not your true purpose. You must defeat something else.
What? My secret desire to live on nothing but breakfast pastries? My growing addiction to anime?
Your comfortable assumptions, your habits of thought, they are not merely ruts in the road keeping you on the path you're following. They are like blindfolds, preventing you from even seeing that there are other paths.
I know that there are other paths.
The Monkey King smirked.
You feel comfortable saying that, don't you?
I bite back a heated reply. For while I am aware that there are other paths, there must be some specific kind that Wukong is referring to, and he knows I'm not seeing it. And he's not suggesting some kind of Yoda deal here, where I must unlearn what I have learned.
He's acknowledged that I'm on a pretty high plateau of martial skill. He wants me to ascend above that somehow.
Or he might be speaking of a completely different path, unrelated to martial arts. For all I know, he might actually want me to watch better anime series than I'm currently watching.
I appreciate the value of ambiguity in some situations, but it's damn infuriating when it's the guardian of a gateway to a deeper knowledge of the self.
And I know the purpose of it. The ambiguity forces the student out of established patterns of thinking, and the subconscious begins to chew at the problem like a tough day-old bagel, even when the conscious mind is otherwise occupied. But knowing the purpose doesn't help. I'm still faced with a mental obstacle course obscured by fog.
Regardless, we are through speaking and training. The Monkey King grasps his staff in his left hand and reaches out his furred right hand to me.
Come, Granuel. It is time to defend humanity, to live or die in the moment. If they win free of Yangmingshan Park, the loss of life will be vast.
I don't know what he intends to do here, so I hold tightly to Skowaja and put my left hand in his right. Sun Wukong grins at me.
Sometimes humans soil themselves when I soar the clouds with them. Do please try not to do that.
What? He cackles, shakes, crouches, and then I'm yanked bodily into the air by his power, swept along in a massive jump toward the boiling, apocalyptic mess of Yangmingshan. In the journey to the west, it is said he can travel 108,000 miles in a single leap, enough to circle the globe 4 times, essentially no different from flying. So this comparatively brief hop to Yangmingshan from Old Taipei is nothing to him but a breathtaking and indeed a possibly pants-shitting experience for me. If it were not for my background flying as a peregrine falcon, I think I might well have had an accident of one kind or another, for as a human it is terrifying to be aloft without visible support. And what we're flying into is terrifying as well. The Monkey King controls our descent to the base of the mountain. We must both bat away skyborne mouths, ravening for our flesh along the way, and on the ground a few figures clear a space for us, because together we make a strange silhouette. Once there, I'm not sure how to feel about what I'm facing. Some of them are clearly demons of unusual physiognomy, and have never been anything but horrid creatures that take delight in the pain of others. But some of what I see are maddened human figures, both male and female, charred or bearing scars of some kind, confused as much as anything else. They are souls working off their bad karma in hell until they can be reincarnated, and they're as worried as I am about what will happen if I kill them like this. Will they immediately be reincarnated, or will they return to their purgatorial hell for centuries more of purification? But there's a certain fatalism to them as well.
these wretched creatures who died who knows how long ago. They know full well they cannot stroll into Taipei and resume their lives as is, being shades of their former selves. They must instead please whatever Yama King is in charge of their hell, and right now their Yama King wants them to slay whatever's in front of them. There's a moment in their faces, a flicker of curiosity in their expressions at why there's suddenly a red-haired white woman here, and then a palpable shrug when they realize it can't matter in their particular scheme of things, right before they lunge at me with sharpened fingernails and feral teeth in mouths gaping wide. The blunt end of my staff thrust between their eyes or a blow to the temple or back of the head ends them quickly. They are unarmed and unskilled and offer no serious threat to me, and I'm saddened by the necessity to hurt them to defend myself. I suppose I'm defending plenty of people back in Taipei, but I don't feel that. Instead, I feel like some sort of monster for taking advantage of their weakness. That is, until a serious demon comes my way, blue-skinned and borne aloft by brightly colored wings akin to peacock feathers, with red, glimmering eyes in a black-toothed visage. He wields a mace dangling on the end of a chain rope, and I know he's a dude because he wears nothing. Wukong? I glance over my shoulder and see that he's already otherwise engaged. This one's all mine, apparently. Some lord of a hell upset that I'm plowing through his forces so quickly.
Have no mercy, Wukong calls over his shoulder. Do not hesitate.
Taking his advice to heart, I pull out a throwing knife from my belt and bullseye the demon in his junk. He shrieks and curls around the shaft buried in his shaft, and I brain him with scowager while he's mourning his nads. That makes the damned pull back from me a bit, and I pause as well.
No, Wukong says. Continue, Granuel. They must all be sent back, you see. These souls must continue their punishment until they can be reborn again. You do nothing wrong by your violence here. You are both protecting the living and helping these souls on their journey.
That wrenches my head around to a different paradigm. I'm not really killing the innocent or anyone. This is a cleanup operation. Sanitation, even. As evidenced by the fact that soon after these vessels die, they melt away, much like demons from the Christian hells do. But thankfully these don't smell as bad.
Just think, the Monkey King said, after another 1,000 years or whatever debt their soul is taken on, these people can be reborn and experience bubble tea.
That's a mighty strange thing to think about in combat while shattering skulls. What shall I say to them right before they die again?
Try the kiwi watermelon flavor when you get a chance!
Or something like that? Would such words even hold meaning for them? Would they hold on to the idea throughout their purgatorial suffering and then through rebirth? Would they even understand a single word of my language? Or might I be communicating to them somehow my personal regret and hope for them? I certainly hope better things for them than mere bubble tea. Their expressions are desperate to simply get through whatever this is, me, hell, whatever, so that they can reach a better place.
Am I helping them to learn and grow?
I ask as more of the damned flood down the mountain and our staffs whirl and thunk against heads, caving in temples and crowns.
Probably a measure of mercy, Wukong replies. We are both giving them quicker deaths than anything they receive from the Yama Kings.
I don't know how merciful it is to send these people right back to be tortured for... Did the Monkey King say 1,000 years? How does one do so much evil in a human lifetime to deserve that much punishment? I imagine someone like a dictator or a serial killer could manage it, but I'm sure all these people weren't such. They were millers who cheated farmers, perhaps, or farmers who didn't take care of their horses, or petty local officials or terrible grandmothers, but not spirits that could do anything in 70 years to earn 1,000 years of punishment, right? I try to shake away the thought, because attempting to judge systems of judgment is how one winds up with a head full of batshit. Pick a system, any system, legal or ecclesiastical, and you'll start to wonder at how anyone could think it was fair. And then you'll realize it was never meant to be fair, but rather was intended to protect the interests of the powerful. And then you're wading through a swamp of cynicism, and your day's ruined. What I like about being a druid in service to Gaia is that Gaia doesn't judge much at all, just the theft of her own life force to kill some other part of her. That's why she prohibits us from using our powers to directly harm others. Otherwise, she's gonna let us sort our judgment for ourselves. Why should Gaia care precisely how people once behaved in Taiwan, or about the spiritual life of a mayfly in Connecticut, or about the deviant proclivities of an alley cat in Kathmandu? She will endure so long as the life upon her keeps reproducing. The violent tides of creatures eating, shitting, and fucking each other are what keep her alive. She's not going to impose morality on that. It is why I have kept my druidic moral code as simple as possible. If you're doing some kind of large-scale harm to Gaia's ecosystems, I'll probably do something to stop you and make you regret doing it. The punishment will be swift and short-term. You'll have the chance to be kind to the Earth afterward, or not, and be judged according to some other system, or not, when you die. You might even die in a fight over whose system of judgment is better. But of course that's not something you can ever know, even in death, because you'll only be judged according to one of the systems, if at all. I'll be long out of your personal picture by that time, and your elements will return to Gaia, perhaps to be reused by some other spirit that needs a flesh cart to walk around in some distant day in the future. Three lines of fire open up down my side, deep scratches from some clawed, hissing creature that slipped inside my guard. My response is to bat his head off his neck like a melon on a stump and draw power to heal. Wukong is right. They will indeed kill me if they can. I need to keep my headspaces firmly separate if I want to ponder questions of judgment in the midst of battle. Though I'm not sure why I should. Wasn't I trying to shake off such thoughts moments ago? I compartmentalize the battle in my Latin headspace, Pugne Diabolos, and retreat to English to consider something new. Perhaps it is my comfortable assumptions about judgment I'm supposed to challenge. The Monkey King and these damned souls certainly have me thinking about it, and I'm at least clear-sighted enough to see I haven't examined my assumptions thoroughly. I can spy room to grow here, even if it is not what Wukong intended. I think my instinctive rejection of judgment comes from meeting too many people who say, on the one hand, that their chosen deity shall judge us all, but then they judge me anyway, rather than leaving it up to the deity they profess to believe in and trust. That's using religion to cudgel people into conformity, and it grinds my gears. But Laksha recently pointed out to me that I'd been judging her decisions in a similar way, not via religion, but via my cultural or even personal views of patriarchy. I do regret judging her, but I don't regret my views, which I suppose is how lots of folks feel about their faiths or deeply held beliefs. That allows me to understand at least how easy it can be to slip into a robe of righteousness and comfortably judge others, even if I don't understand or agree with the viewpoints others are coming from. I suppose what I'd really like to understand is our collective urge to focus on differences rather than similarities. I know our brains sort and categorize by default because that's a survival mechanism. That mushroom's good to eat, that one will kill you. That one will have you seeing wacky shit, like mangoes and papayas complaining to pineapples that millennials are killing the fruit juice industry. But despite this hard wiring, there has to be a way of thinking that will allow us to see non-lethal differences and celebrate them, rather than point at them and judge them unworthy. For we seem to be ever running toward dystopias, rather than the other way. The Polish poet whose work I'm absorbing is a headspace, Wisława Szymborska, wrote about the loneliness of utopia and how utterly bereft it is of actual people. As if all you can do here is leave, and plunge never to return in the depths, into unfathomable life. It's an apt metaphor. I often feel that I'm swimming in a vast ocean, a lonely mackerel who's lost her school and is trying to find her way back, or else find some other bunch of fish that will let her swim along with them. Meanwhile, utopia is above the surface, somewhere, and I have no clue. Is that what the Monkey King was talking about? A path to peace I'm incapable of seeing. How do I know? Wait. Wukong? I say, looking around briefly to make sure he's still close enough to hear me. He's not far, but I repeat myself a bit louder in case he didn't hear me in the din. Yes! How do I know if I have good judgment? He barks out a few simian laughs. Do you like bubble tea? That seems like an inconsequential detail, but perhaps even my judgment of that is suspect. Still, it's a bit of a no-brainer, because it's delicious. Yes, I tell him. And what do you think of this fellow coming our way down the mountain, tall and armored and wielding a sword that looks longer than you stretched out on the ground? He chucks his chin uphill, and I try to steal a glance up there while making sure none of the damned take advantage of my distraction. The figure he's talking about is impossible to miss. The plates of golden armor gleaming and etched and tied on top of red leathers, his malevolence and power distorting the air around him like heat bouncing off asphalt in the summer.
I think he looks dangerous.
Then I think your judgment is sound. That is Wu Guan, the fourth Yama King of Yingjian.
I don't suppose there's a chance of us hugging this out? Wu Guan utters a death metal grunt that vibrates in my bones and raises his sword, his mad eyes locked firmly on me rather than on Wukong. His muscles bunch and I can see he's gonna charge, or, I don't know, something aggressive.
Wukong, none of my assumptions about this guy are comfortable right now. Does that make you happy?
Let's talk afterward, if you beat him,
the Monkey King says, and Wu Guan roars, leaping into the air with his sword held high.
Chapter 16. We've heard of the Amazon, of course, but it's not something I can really comprehend. A vast river spanning a continent that's the breadth of 9 feckin' islands or something like that. We have lots of bunny water on the Emerald Isle, but not concentrated in a river that bloody wide or long. And it doesn't hide alligators and piranhas and the like either, or huge great snakes that have somehow become euphemisms for a man's Mickey. I'll tell you what, lads, the day I see a Mickey that can wrap itself around a full-grown man and squeeze him to death is the day I stop even trying to have sex. The tree I used to shift in is right by the bank of the Amazon, near a city in Peru called Iquitos. I don't realize it when I get there, but later I find out that you can't get to this city by car. You have to either fly in or float in on the river, or shift in like me, using a tether tree. They have local transport in the city, roads and such, but the roads don't cut through the forest otherwise. Still, it's not a wee town. It's 500,000 people, and it smells like they've been here for a while. Sheehan told me that the most of this continent got colonized by the Spanish and Portuguese. Those were a couple of the big colonial powers, along with the British, French, and Dutch, who used gunpowder and disease to make the world such a European bollocks.
The Irish,
he says to me during that history lesson,
were among the first to be colonized.
I shan't lie to ye, that sticks in me arse like a toothpick shoved in sideways. Can't blame anyone who's resentful of those colonial powers, or the destructive swath they cut through the world. Whole peoples have been erased by them, others enslaved by them, but it goes further than the human cost, as far as the earth's concerned. Gaia herself has paid a huge price for such arrogance. Here in Peru, for example, the Incas had 400 different kinds of potatoes, and the Spanish wiped almost all of them out. They brought a few kinds back to Europe, and that became a huge staple food for the Irish, which is why Sheehan bothered to tell me about it. But the diversity was gone. There used to be a whole bunch of bananas, too, if you will pardon me pun. But now you have just a few kinds left, and some plantains. Sheehan says he regrets not saving some of those in a seed bank or something like that. But he didn't realize it was happening, because potatoes and bananas don't have death screams. Extinctions are sad, lonesome exits by the last few specimens, often silent and always tragic, and they're still happening. Something around Iquitos is fed up with that. It's decided humans are the problem. And much like Bavaria told me to take out the problematic kobolds, it's taken out humans in this isolated city surrounded by the jungle. Except it's no single thing doing the damage. That's the true problem here. A swarm of wasps swoops down on an auto rickshaw, a noisy three-wheeled open-air machine, and proceeds to sting everyone inside to a screaming death. Clouds of mosquitoes settle on others like a blood-sucking horror show. Monkeys have come out of the trees to throw rocks and anything they can find at people's heads from the rooftops. Birds of all kinds dive and peck at eyes, but the harpy eagles are especially deadly. There's a jaguar chasing people down and tearing out throats.
The best thing for everyone right now would be to get indoors and stay there, but I would not be surprised to learn that people are getting attacked by their own pets. I greet the Amazon Elemental and hope she might be able to help me figure this out. Query, what is the source of this attack?
Nature Goddess.
That part was at least partially expected. The disturbance here could hardly be organized by anything else. But it sure does pluck the string labeled wrong on me personal harp. It doesn't make sense that a nature deity would join Loki under any circumstances, if he could even communicate with one. I mean, as soon as a nature deity heard Loki say, "First, we're gonna burn everything," it should have kicked his gibbering arse for opening his gob. So I think this must be a reaction to the chaos erupting elsewhere. Nature's having a rough go of it thanks to Loki's shenanigans, and the deity here is thinking globally, but acting locally, blaming humans for the mess. Query, where do I find her?
Unknown.
Bollocks. Query, name of deity?
Unknown.
Hairy bollocks. Damn it, sweaty ones that smell like dodgy cottage cheese. I need to know more if I'm gonna figure out how to deal with this. A red-furred monkey scampers above me head and I reach out to him, binding me mind to his, and ask him who sent him. I get a mental shrug, a shriek, and a rock thrown at me head in reply. I duck into a place that looks like a restaurant, advertising something called Tacacho. Who speaks English? I ask the room, and a few hands go up, including the lad behind the register. I approach him and tell him thanks. Do we have a nature goddess people pray to around here? My question is heard by several people, and they all respond the same way. Pachamama, they say. They exchange glances and trade tiny smiles and nods, recognizing fellow worshippers. Ah, good. What does she look like? That gives me some confusion.
You look for art?
The lad behind the register says. He's young, probably not old enough to drink yet. No, no, I don't want art. I'm not a tourist. I want to know what you think she looks like. Because if this deity has manifested anywhere near here, she's gonna look something like what her worshippers envision in their minds.
Big.
The register lad throws his hands wide like he's describing the fish he caught yesterday.
No, no.
One of the patrons says, his mouth full of whatever Tacacho is. A bit of it spits out as he tries to talk around it.
Long hair, many colors, healthy size, not big or small, made of plants and animals. What? No, she looks human and has normal brown skin.
Someone else says.
She's mother of all,
the eating fella says.
Not just humans. She is not confined to human form.
I can see why Amazon had difficulty identifying where she might be. Judging by these varying descriptions, she could manifest as nearly anything. What is she like, huh? Does she have a temper?
No, no. She is gentle and loving,
the boy at the register says, and the others agree. That doesn't fit with the wrath going on outside, and the patrons here seem largely unaware that it's happening. That changes when an auto rickshaw crashes through the huge front window pane and a feckin' plague of something flying comes with it. We've never seen people fill their pants with shite so fast. When the first thing stings me, I understand why. Because it bloody hurts. I realize I'm a target as is, but there's a simple solution. Cease being human. I shapeshift to a red kite and let me clothes fall off, emerging through the neck of me shirt and flying right out the window past all the stinging insects, which only want to sting humans. I spiral higher and higher and then circle the borders of the city, looking for something that might qualify as a nature goddess stomping around. Off to the east, near what I later find out is the Belen district, I think I see something worth investigating. Treetops, not quite tree-like, moving against the prevailing wind. I ride up on a thermal, gaining more altitude, and see that there's a river there, the Itaya, in fact, a tributary to the Amazon. The housing, especially on the other side, is the most basic shelter, built on stilts to allow for seasonal flooding. The people there living crowded together in awful conditions, and I worry they may already be dead, for what I see peeking over the treetops across the river is a creature of wrath, and the swarms are flowing from that direction to the city. I don't want to try to fly against that, so I angle around to land on the bank to the south, flanking it, and once on the ground I shift into a bear. If a jaguar wants to take me on, I figure I'll give it a proper fight that way. I doubt these jungles have any bigger predators than that, apart from the swarms of this ant or that hornet. There's no time to be cautious after that. People are dying, and I need to figure out how to stop it. I rumble north along the eastern bank of the Itaya until I arrive at what is unmistakably a manifestation of Pachamama. Once I get a good look, I understand why the Amazon Elemental couldn't figure out where she was, for she is not any one thing distinct unto herself. She's a collection. No, there's a fancy-arsed word for it. An amalgamation of plants and animals, all forming the shape of a human woman 20 feet tall or so. She's made of vines and monkeys and saplings and beeswax and every feckin' thing in the jungle. She is both terrifying and beautiful. I don't know half of what I'm looking at since I'm not from around here, and lots of these species are new to me. I have two apprentices, though, Luis and Oscar, who come from different ends of the Amazon. Oscar is from Peru, but Luis from Brazil. He's undoubtedly the biggest animal lover of me whole grove. Either one of them could probably tell me what I'm looking at in great detail. All I can tell is that it's a seething mass of mammals and birds and insects around a skeleton of wood and vines, and it's powerful mad and a right glory all at once, staring at the human city across the river with churning eyeballs made of fiery red army ants and bending all her will to destroying everyone living there. Should Gaia ever choose to manifest herself, I imagine she might look something like this, but on the scale of mountains. Figuring out how to talk to her is going to be the problem. She's manifested from local belief and they speak Spanish around here, which means that's probably what she speaks. That's not one I've picked up yet, apart from a few words. I can't even tackle that, however, until I figure out where she's keeping her consciousness for this manifestation. She has so many critters hanging out in her skull that I can't find hers. It's a frustrating search in the magical spectrum. I even look around in the chest cavity for something special, thinking perhaps she'd be keeping herself where the heart should be. But all I can pick up is an overall glow suffusing her constructed body, which does have hair of many colours, the strands made up of vines covered in various furred and feathered animals. I grunt a bear's equivalent of, "Oh, shite!" when the answer is precisely that overall glow. Pachamama is a manifestation of nature, so her identity is not separate from that body, but rather shared among everything in it. She's the sum of those many parts, which is why Amazon could not locate her specifically. She is a distributed consciousness, or maybe the proper word would be diffused. I still feckin' hate English. But it gives me an idea. If I bind with an animal that's part of her, that should be a way in. I choose a somewhat goofy-looking creature, hanging onto a knotted bowl around her ankle. It has a smile on its face, very long arms, and three enormous claws on each hand. A three-toed sloth, I later learn. Louise would love it. I've had frequent practice with the binding of mines, thanks to Sheahan's hounds, and it's a quick process now. Not sure how quick the speaking bit will go, but fortunately, once the binding's made, a whole lot can be communicated through emotion, imagery, and intent, rather than spoken words. Rendering it into mere sentences later is like hitting a dartboard's outer rings instead of the bullseye, but at least it counts toward some kind of understanding. "Hello," I says. "I'm a druid of Gaia. May I speak to Pachamama?" The creature slowly looks around at the animals teeming around it on the ankle and foot of the giant goddess. Her mental voice is affable and kind.
"Who said that in my head?"
Or did I eat some leaves with a trippy fungus on them again?
Me? Over here, to your left? That big black furry thing? I look like a bear.
Wow. You're different. I haven't seen anything like you in the jungle before.
I'm not from around here. May I speak to Pachamama?
You're bigger than anything. Kinda blowing my mind. You probably spend all day eating stuff. Whoa. Hey, you won't eat me, will you?
No, I won't. Pachamama, please?
Oh, yeah.